Chapter 1. You're too nice looking to work for hospice. Being made welcome by my new career. I started looking for hospice work in 2005 as I wrapped up a 3-year contract with Progressive Temple Beth Ahavat Shalom in Brooklyn, New York. Though I had my share of detractors while serving there, I did have my ardent fans as well. As my contract was drawing to a close, I interviewed for pulpit as well as hospice positions, being ambivalent about leaving congregational life. The congregation was unaware that I was considering serving at hospice. As of yet unannounced to a soul, soon after I got the offer from United Hospice of Rockland, one of these fans said, "Rabbi, I don't care how far away your next post is, I will follow you there." I told him I was overwhelmed with his faithfulness and touching sentiments, but that he would not want to fulfill his vow, as the only way he would be following me would be as a hospice patient. A portrait painter would have had a heyday capturing the motley crew of emotions all over his face. And that was one of the more positive reactions to my announcement of my career plans. One person made such an expression of disgust, you would think I had already ritually defiled myself from contact with the dead, as described in the book of Leviticus. He was afraid I would be contaminating him in no time. Sure enough, he backed away from our remaining opportunities to get together over coffee. Someone else, upon hearing the news, raised his arms as if to protect himself, emitted an "Oh!" looked away, and retreated a step or two. Mentioning my new career to my congregants definitely was a way to throw a curveball into a conversation. Nowadays, there is a mischievous part of me that sometimes gets a kick out of springing the surprise upon unsuspecting listeners such as fellow bed and breakfast guests. Yet another congregant gave me a knowing look, saying, "That is just the kind of job that would suit you." Maybe I was imagining it, having been stung by the premature end of my tenure, but it felt like the subtext of that remark was, "A pulpit rabbi you should not or could not ever be." I had visited her a number of times for bereavement care, listening to her accounts of family lost in the Holocaust. Another reaction from multiple members of the congregation was, "Oh, so you're retiring." So onward I went with all these votes of confidence to life at the edge. Though to be fair, some people greatly respect and marvel at this form of service. And, as with all new challenges, I was indeed on edge about what lay ahead. In addition to dealing with those often skeptical responses, I was not sure how a handicap of mine would play out in this new setting. I have a listening disorder that is hard to explain, and therefore hard to get people to make adjustments for. When I hear other sounds the same time that I hear speech, my brain does not allow me to ignore the extraneous sounds and focus on the speech. I hear everything, but what I hear takes some wrong turns as the brain interprets the sounds. So when I'm with friends in a restaurant, for example, the conversations at the other tables, the sounds of dishes being washed, the background music, and especially the sounds of coffee makers, all compete to make hearing my friends a fatiguing enterprise. This is probably what it's like for a person communicating in a second language that they do not know very well. As I discovered, nursing homes are full of noise, and sometimes the patient I was visiting spoke softly. So I did what I could to steer the patient out of the common areas and into her room or some quiet nook. I may have what is called central auditory processing disorder, but I never have sought a formal diagnosis. I had to contend with this problem from the start, with my colleagues too. If an air conditioner was rattling away at a meeting, I had to concentrate very hard to understand what they were saying. If the door was open with the copier chugging away, same effect. No matter how closely I concentrate on what people are saying on the job or off, I can guarantee you I miss a certain percentage of what is being said. More often than not, there will be some background noise, which the normal brain unconsciously and automatically screens out, but my brain doesn't. So, if a social worker and I were standing in a hallway to discuss a patient, and I heard a car going by through an open window, I would miss some of what she was saying until the sound of the car faded away. Even when I forewarn my colleagues and friends about this listening disorder, they often forget about the problem or misunderstand it and think I'm partially deaf. Moreover, my processing of speech in a noisy place takes longer, and so I confuse and annoy people with my slow reaction time. A fellow chaplain once told me that talking to me is like when a newscaster on TV says something to another one at a different location, and there's a brief delay before the latter hears what is said, and then finally responds. And so, that is why I revere and seek quiet, or at least I'm grateful when I can hear one thing at a time, be it a conversation, a piece of music, a colleague's report, or the change in a patient's breathing, from labored to relaxed and steady. As I listen and as I encounter each new patient, I wonder, like an explorer of new worlds, what unique features will come my way. In the first weeks of my first hospice job, I had plenty to adjust to. First, I had to learn how I knew which patients to contact. At any given time, a certain number of patients are on the hospice program, and they usually get there via a referral from their doctor. They have to fit criteria that more or less predict that given the usual course of the disease, the patient will live for about 6 months. Some of these criteria are unplanned substantial weight loss, increased sleeping, incontinence, loss of interest in life, and of course the malady itself, such as cancer or heart disease. Once admitted, the patients might be living at home, in a nursing home, in an assisted living facility, or be in the middle of a hospital stay. At some hospices, they might also be in that hospice's residence. Unless a patient or family member explicitly asks the admission nurse to tell the chaplain not to contact them, my initial task is to phone them. Then, if requested, within 5 days of admission, I will visit each new patient. After the first contact, I make further visits depending on the needs and wishes of the patients and their families. So practically the first day at my new job, I had to telephone a list of 40 strangers during a crisis situation in their lives and see if they wished to have an unknown quantity like me drop by to visit for spiritual support. Meanwhile, the Christian chaplain, Bruce, was telephoning his 40 families as we both got hired at the same time. There we were in a building filled with about 100 employees, from human resources personnel to bookkeepers to medical record coordinators, to all those who are said to go in the field, such as nurses, social workers, music therapists, home health aides, and of course, chaplains. As I made the calls, I was relieved at how courteous the families were. I must have figured that under such an emotionally volatile situation, they would have directed their anger and helplessness at me. I was so nervous that day. I was glad that most of them declined my offer to visit or even call again. It was hard enough just learning how to document online. Computers have to be extremely user-friendly for me to catch on quickly. For each call and visit, I had to enter what happened in their medical record, even if it were a short note like, "No chaplain desired at this time." The main reason I was relieved not to have to make many visits initially was that I had to learn all new driving directions, starting with, as I left the building, should I turn left or right? And where was that back entrance again? In those days, I did not have a navigator, and I was more phobic about learning new directions. Some of the patients lived nearby, but government rules allow hospices to admit patients who are as far as 50 miles away from the agency building. To admit a patient more than that is not allowed because it could take too long for a member of the team to get there and give urgently needed assistance such as pain relief. When two or more chaplains are working at the same agency, one of the tricky logistical tasks is to figure out which chaplain gets which patients. Aside from special requests for a chaplain to be of a certain religion, the main criterion for dividing up patients among chaplains is geography. But this is not easy, as of course each chaplain would like to visit patients that are either close to the agency or who live close to the chaplain's own home. My husband likes to kid that when I telephone patients who live 50 miles away, I should say, "You don't really need a chaplain today now, do you?" Traveling for visits could get very involved too, because patients can be scattered in all four directions, theoretically up to 100 miles away from each other, and not necessarily be clustered near each other. On a big traveling day, I can easily log 130 miles, including the commute to and from the office. The logistics can get even more complicated when one chaplain is out sick or on vacation. At United Hospice of Rockland, when Chaplain Bruce was away for a few days, I had to assign new patients to him and to myself, call Bruce's patients to see if they wanted to see him next week, and document the results online for his and mine. We had agreed that every other new admission would be his while I took the rest. One time when a patient lived at that 50-mile borderline out in Sloatsburg somewhere and was not conveniently near any of my other patients, I could not resist assigning that outlier to Bruce, even though that patient should have been mine. Should I feel guilty? Maybe not, because he probably returned the favor when I was away. The actual door-to-door travel itself that all the team had to take can be an adventure all its own. Driving, I quickly discovered, can consume more of the day. Much, much more than the visit themselves, due to distance, bad weather, horrific traffic, or of course getting lost. Not only that, the risk for accidents probably ranks travel time a greater occupational hazard than the possibility of catching some disease, like the flu, making its rounds in the nursing homes. Of at least equal concern is that despite cell phones and navigators, each of us is alone in the car, and therefore vulnerable to mishaps and ticklish situations, such as rude gas attendants and iffy neighborhoods. And by the time I make it all the way there, the patient may have died in the meantime. Or the patient might have changed his mind about seeing me by then, or have gone to sleep for the day. Relatively rare, the patient has not even been home, possibly because despite the call I make hours before I set out, he forgot. Or someone else with him did, and took him on an outing. Drat, I say to myself, among other less professional things, as I trudge back to the doggone car, kicking any ill-fated debris that dares to cross my way. My husband teases me that after a day like that, when we get rich, my chauffeur will drive me around in our Mercedes. But hospice salaries, being what they are at approximately $25 an hour, hospice pay will never be a source of wealth. I have joked with friends that I travel around like a truck driver, but get paid far less. I know this is hyperbole, as truck drivers travel considerably more than I do. Like anything else, such as what I happen to be wearing, I learned that the kind of car I have can be a patient's topic of choice, or inspire skepticism on the part of security at gated communities. For a while, I was driving a sporty, dazzling blue 1994 Mustang, while my sedate Honda Civic was in for repairs. I noticed that unlike when I had my Honda, when I drove up to the gate to enter those communities, security was not as quick to wave me in. They looked askance at my hot rod, asked for my ID, and scrutinized it at length before taking a gamble on senior safety. Once my car and I were in the grounds, a few patients pointed to the vehicle and made remarks such as, "That's your car?" "I did not expect you, of all people, to have a car like that." I suppose my unholy roller reduced my credibility. I never ever got remarks implying an unexpected incongruity between car and chaplain when I drove the Honda. One of my most ridiculous and awkward driving predicaments, a perfect story for the Tappet Brothers radio program Car Talk, happened as I was leaving a rest stop near exit 8A, headed northbound on the New Jersey Turnpike. Naturally, just as I had irrevocably pulled out and had proceeded onto the highway, my nose started to bleed like its contents had to rush to an emergency exit. Fortunately, I had a few tissues within clutching distance, but even so, the interval between realizing what was taking place, carefully removing one hand from the wheel at some 50 miles per hour to get the tissues without looking at them, and at long last bringing them firmly toward my nose and holding them there, left plenty of time for me and my clothes to get an extremely red makeover. I did not have much choice but to keep driving to the next rest stop several miles away with one hand on the wheel and one tissue-filled hand on my face. Keeping my eyes on the road conflicted with, but took first priority over keeping said nose up in the air to staunch the rosy output. I thought about pulling over to the shoulder with just one hand, but at the high speed I was traveling, such a sudden drop would have been too perilous. A race car driver, I am not. I think I then put on my blinkers and anxiously, yet stalwartly, kept going, the next rest stop several miles away. When I got there, I was faced with the nerve-wracking task of negotiating the sharply curved ramp with mostly one hand and milliseconds of intermittent help from the other. For the grand finale, I single-handedly made an abrupt turn into a parking space. Double woo! After leaning back and pinching my nose to stop the flow, I went in to wash up. I must have looked like I had been mauled. It could have been worse. What if no tissues had been sitting on the seat or alongside the pockets of the car? Or as sometimes happens, all of my tissues had gone on strike and disappeared. But then again, my half-empty glass self-scolded, my half-full glass self-saying, did I really have to be all by my lonesome and have this micro-melodrama happen far from local roads and a good 16 miles to the next rest area? Talk about a red-letter day. Besides getting used to calls, driving, and visits, there were meetings to attend at the agency, such as learning the rules for functioning as part of the healthcare team. For example, we had to clue each other in on the patient's needs. If I saw that a patient was in pain, I was to notify the nurse. If a social worker heard a patient expressing ambivalence about their religious beliefs, she was to let me know. And I learned so much about how to wash my hands, about the most important way to avoid infection of oneself and others. I'm sure I could give a 20-minute, hands-on presentation on the subject. Another agency meeting subjected us to a detailed review of sexual harassment, complete with a hokey video of two of our own supervisors posing as coworkers, with one coworker accidentally brushing past the other. After some basic definitions, the speaker gave example after example of subtle borderline cases, such as when a male supervisor might with all innocence make comments on a female subordinate's appearance. The assumption throughout the presentation was that most sexual harassment is done by men to women. Somehow I was not too worried about my leading anyone into temptation with my feminine charms. Of all the hospice personnel in the entire agency, there are about 2 men in the whole lot. I also attended meetings in the broader community, such as the local board of rabbis. When I introduced myself as the new hospice chaplain in town, one rabbi, they were all or nearly all male, as I recall, said, "You're with hospice? You are far too nice-looking to be in hospice work." I wondered if that meant death and my legendary beauty didn't go together. I also fidgeted at what felt like a left-handed compliment. Did that imply my beauty had not opened more prestigious doors for me? But from their side, I sensed relief in the air that my being involved with hospice instead of pulpits meant that I would not be competing with them. It also meant I was no threat to the distribution of rabbinic power in that town. I knew about that sort of dynamic all too well from my pulpit work, which had power issues all of its own. The members of the Board of Trustees often wanted power and prestige more than spiritual fulfillment. As a pulpit rabbi, I felt like I was playing the part of a mayor, who not only must maintain her own place as a leader, but also constantly deal with various factions and watch her back. Those factions sometimes had conflicting or at least different needs and hopes. I saw that those were not the sort of circumstances I was skilled at, a view both charitable to myself as well as to the congregation, whereas I was most effective at caring for individual congregants in crisis. Thus, I switched to a career as a professional chaplain. I can share plenty of anecdotes with you that showed me that pulpit work was not my long-term destiny. I will confine myself to 2. At a temple in Parsippany, New Jersey, soon after a new temple president was elected in the middle of my first contract term, I fell out of favor. About half of the rank-and-file members hoped I would stay, and about half did not. Most of the Board of Trustees wanted me to be an unintended interim rabbi and not renew my contract. This, in itself, is par for the course in retrospect. What really shook me up, though, and still astounds me today, is the following. After services at most temples, the congregants help themselves to refreshments and sit down at tables to socialize. At this particular temple, there was an aisle that divided the seating area in half. Someone told me that the people who wanted me to stay for another term sat on one side of that aisle, the rest on the other. And that when someone crossed over to the other side, there was talk. They would be asked why they were not in their own side. Once I left that temple, I was deeply saddened to hear that many friendships had foundered between people who liked me and people who did not. To suffer the results of political maneuvers as a religious leader is one thing, causing me acute spiritual distress. But the havoc it works upon the faith of the rank and file is quite another, counting as a far more grievous sin. The second anecdote has to do with a congregation in Long Island City, in Queens, New York. With no provocation that I knew of, one random day, someone impersonated me on the phone and called the chairman of the board at around 2:00 in the morning. The caller said something about having to talk to him then. The chairman then woke me up soon after with a call of his own to me, infuriated to such an extent he could not completely believe me when I said I did not and of course would not ever make such a call. "Someone in the congregation sure must hate you to go to such lengths," my brother said. I never did find out who impersonated me, which, by the way, in the state of New York, is illegal, since the intent was to injure my reputation. It could be that the chairman himself made this up. If that seems implausible, how plausible is the other scenario? I chuckle at the absurdity of these 2 anecdotes now, but at the time, these and all the other manifestations of power plays and divisiveness constantly threw me off balance and afflicted my innermost being. If you do not believe these stories, or you think this just happens in Jewish houses of worship, or that it just happened to me because of my own shortcomings, A May 2012 Google search revealed over 200,000 entries on clergy burnout. As one example of how extensive this problem is, a book was published with the melodramatic title, Clergy Killers: Guidance for Clergy and Congregations Under Attack, by G. Lloyd Rediger. Interestingly, such dysfunction is not even peculiar to houses of worship. As C.P. Snow said in The Affair, his novel about the intricate political maneuverings of a college faculty over the ouster of one of their colleagues, one can forget how intense and open the emotions could show in a closed society. He goes on to say, the curious thing is, in terms of person-to-person conflict, when one moves from high affairs to the college, one moves from a more sheltered life to a less. And so, the lack of protection from my proponents and the distress I suffered in pulpit life was not even about religion, but about fundamental human behavior in any small, lasting, informal society. In comparison with the emotionally wrenching years in pulpit work, the adjustments I have had to make to chaplaincy have been kid stuff. As you will see in the story below, not only did I adapt to serving people who were not Jewish, but also found my way to nourishing their spiritual needs. One of my very first visits as a hospice chaplain was to Judy, who was the matriarch of her family. She was an African-American who was just hours from the end and unable to speak. Her husband and other loved ones were quietly arrayed near her bed or sitting gingerly on it in an expansive bedroom. As her daughter gestured for me to sit on the edge of the bed, I glanced around their upscale home and thought about how the beauty of their surroundings seemed to mock the ugliness of what they were going through. They had asked me to pray, and I offered generically spiritual words from the heart, trying to unobtrusively avoid the J word, so I would not falsely express something contrary to my beliefs. What I often say in such cases is something like, may your loved one feel God's nearness. God's love is all around us, surrounding us. Judy, this love is going from your head to your feet. God is your protector, who neither slumbers nor sleeps, and you will be welcomed in God's embrace. We give thanks for the love that this family has given and received. There was a reverent mood, and Judy's daughter joyfully said, we are so comforted to have a Christian presence at this time. This is one of many amusing situations I would bring home to hubby to enliven dinner. Of course, how I handle my identity is a serious matter for each family. In this particular case, I deemed it more important that the family felt comforted than intellectually enlightened as to who I really was. I was already different enough, being white, and I did not wish to throw my differences into even sharper relief. I hoped I was serving them at the more universal level of a human offering ministry. One of the draws of being a chaplain is the potential to transcend racial, religious, ethnic, and other boundaries which can all shrink to insignificance in the face of impending death. While I am not a Christian clergy person, to that family I was ushering in God's love and care within a familiar and therefore comforting framework, that of a standard-issue chaplain. Of course, if they asked me to officiate at the funeral or had become puzzled by my Jesus-free prayer, I would have had to gently explain that I was Jewish and see if they would have preferred the services of the Christian chaplain on the team for future contact. My Christian counterpart had his own challenges when it comes to interfaith work. I remember a colleague telling me, when I pray with a Jewish patient and I don't end the prayer with an In Jesus' name, amen, I feel like I'm writing an email without pushing the send button. To which another colleague retorted, that may be, but to the Jewish patient, as soon as they hear Jesus, that's like hitting the delete button. All in all, though, the interfaith nature of my work often enables all parties to push past religious barriers and to resonate with the spiritual values virtually all religions share. Take, for example, a situation where the patient was dying of AIDS. His son John was in jail, and though the prison did not even allow him to visit his father on his deathbed, I knew that with the chaplain-to-chaplain contact, there would be a good chance that he would be allowed to make a telephone call that same day to his father. The prison chaplain I contacted happened to be Muslim. So there we were, Muslim and Jew, collaborating on behalf of a Baptist patient. I never did find out if the call came to pass. As is often the case in hospice care, carrying out such actions depends on many factors. In this case, the prison warden, the nursing home staffer who first answered the phone, and whether the patient was awake at the time. Chaplaincy unites not only religions, but groups within religions. When I attend the National Association of Jewish Chaplains annual conference, the differences among Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform Jews do not matter a jot. I owe my comfort and even fascination with diverse cultures to my upbringing. My parents were very open to receiving visitors from other countries and other ethnic groups. I remember the time my parents' Russian friends brought along friends from their church choir between Christmas and New Year's. They sang some folk tunes for us and conversed amongst themselves in Russian. I remember, too, how my mother inadvertently frightened them when she asked them to mail a letter for her after they left. They did not do so, perhaps fearing that the letter had to do with notifying the authorities about them, because they carried many bad memories from Russia about the KGB. Other visitors, I remember, included a biracial couple, very unusual in the 1960s, especially in a small city like Erie, Pennsylvania. I became interested enough in other cultures to become a foreigner myself. I attended a semester abroad program in college. While living for one summer in Puerto de la Libertad, El Salvador, and then for one semester in the cities of Bogotá and Silvia in Colombia, I felt the freedom and stimulation of being in places with different norms than where I was raised. It fascinated me to experience wearing ponchos, to lunch on huge papayas and luscious soft mangoes, and to witness celebrations for the communal construction of indigenous homes. I was also exposed to new attitudes toward time, more laid back, religion, more loosely defined, and money, far scarcer. As I learned about the Hispanic and indigenous cultures, as well as the Spanish language, I felt like I was in an alternate reality. Visiting with patients, particularly the first time, is something like a sojourn in a foreign country, too. I have to learn the language of their assumptions as formed by their life history, their lingo as shaped by their religious heritage, and their private secret code as they encounter the edge of the beyond. My job is to enter their rapidly shifting terrain to help them make sense of their past, present, and future. In the coming chapters, I invite you to explore more of these foreign places with me in this sometimes disturbing, sometimes uplifting, and sometimes surprising journey.